Hello and welcome to another installment of History Hack. I'm really excited today. This one is so overdue because Woody is part of Team History Hack. We all remember Woody. He did all of the Band of Brothers stuff with us. He's a World War II guru with his own World War II TV. He's been working his nuts off of late. Are you knackered, Woody? A
little bit, yeah.
And France is pretty much back in lockdown, right?
Yeah, it's just... Yeah, a bit busy, but anyway, it's good. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, and you can be the guest this time. You haven't got to be the one that knows everything. I'll do all the hard work. You can just tell us a story. How does that sound?
That sounds really good, yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, Woody wrote a book in 2013 called Angels of Mercy, and we're basically going to give you an outline of what it was about, because it's a fantastic story and it's rightly getting some exciting attention at the moment behind the scenes, which we won't say anything about, but just keep our fingers crossed for you. But when obviously we're talking World War II, because this is you. Yeah. When are we talking in World War II? And it's set in one single building, basically, isn't it? So what village are we in and why?
It's Angleville-au-Plain, which is just 4 or 5 miles inland from Utah Beach on the main road towards Carentan. So a little.
So we're talking D-Day.
We're talking D-Day. And D-Day in the next 36 hours. Mm-hmm. Although the book does flesh out the story of the village in the war before that day and take the story a little bit afterwards. But it focuses on, obviously, the critical 48 hours of the invasion.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, just tell us quickly a bit about the village and what they... And so they're under German occupation, obviously.
Yeah, they are. And they had an interesting time before D-Day because there was a bombing raid earlier in the year on the Sottvast V1 installation that was about 15 miles north. And long story short, as often was the case, there was a cloud cover and navigation issues and the bombs all fell on the village of Angerville, 15 miles away from the intended target. And there's a really clear aerial photo showing all of these craters. And these are big ones. These are big 500-pound bombs. Mercifully, there was no one killed in the village, but that was their sort of baptism of fire, if you like, because that area inland hadn't really been targeted in the pre-D-Day campaign because there was nothing of any significance in the village. So that was their sort of awakening. And then the arrival of Georgian troops, Austrian troops in the village who were, by all accounts, not particularly friendly. So, it starts off the book before the invasion with those little details. But it's a village of, it's about a dozen houses almost at its peak. You know, it's a tiny little village and it was just off the main road. Mm. And even myself coming to Normandy since I was in my 20s, it was one of those little side roads that I never had inclination to turn up. And then when I did, then you kind of start realizing that this village had a little story to tell. That's where the idea came from, really.
It's insane. So it's Utah Beach, and that's what it all ties in with. So you're going to talk to us about two specific guys, aren't you? So who are they, and how do they end up on Utah Beach?
Well, they say they're inland from Utah Beach, and their names are Robert Wright, or Bob, as I call him, and Kenneth Moore, Ken, as I called him. And they were two medics in the 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment of the 101st Airborne, 20 years and 19 years old, respectively. And they were due to land on Drop Zone D, which was the inundated one sort of near to Carentan. And it's the least talked about drop zone, really, because... the units landing there didn't have the same kind of exciting objectives of some on other drop zones where they had vital crossroads and bridges to knock out. These guys were kind of just land there and kill the Germans who are there and hope they don't kill you, if that sort of makes sense. So it didn't have that strategic look. So it's been overlooked for years, really, that particular drop zone. And their job as medics was simply to end up at a predetermined medical facility, if you like, with surgeons in place. And the medics are really only there to put bandage on and call doctor, really. They're not supposed to do much more than that. 20 and 19 years old.
Well, they're babies, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, Ken had about 3 weeks training to be a medic. And interestingly, the reason he became a medic is they showed his battalion, one of those sort of black and white 16 millimeter sort of army training films of combat injuries, And it was quite graphic of earlier campaigns for US Army. And the guys that didn't either vomit or faint were kind of taken to one side and said, "Do you want to be a medic?" And they were like, "Do you want to be, as in you are?" And that's how Ken ended up being a medic, because he hadn't thrown up at this rather graphic film.
That's quite a sketchy recruitment policy.
It is. It's slightly dubious. Bob, on the other hand, had actually, prior to World War II, hoped to have a career as a nurse, which in the kind of reverse sexism way of that era, that wasn't a thing boys did. That was a girl's thing. But he wanted to be a nurse. And then World War II happened. And when he enlisted, he volunteered to join the paratroops, he went straight into the medical branch, and he got 3 months of training, which sounds quite a lot, but then a lot of that is going to be, you know, lots of boring lectures and things. You know, ask a doctor how much they would learn in 3 months. And it's
essentially first aid, isn't it? You get a first aid course and then you get thrown
in. First aid kit. Yeah, exactly. And they're only really meant to be, as I said earlier, as assistants to properly trained surgeons who are jumping in with the battalion. But of course, as we all know, with the D-Day jumps, everybody got scattered and everybody was in the wrong place, and people found themselves on their own having to do all sorts of things above and beyond their pay grade, which is exactly what happened to these two young guys in the village of Angerville.
Just sidebar, where are they born? Where are they from in America?
Ken is from California, Sonoma County, wine country. Mm-hmm. And Bob is from Columbus, Ohio. So semi-rural, but quite near a city.
Long, long way from Normandy. How do they get to the village then?
Well, the Ken had the more harrowing start, because the aircraft he was in took a hit or two, and others in the same flight were hit, because this was one of the last jumps of D-Day, and the German flak positions were kind of ready for them by that point. So he sees aircraft being hit and burning and what have you, and he jumped out and landed in about 4 foot of water, because it's the flooded area, and had to decide very, very quickly whether or not to try and retain the plasma bag he jumped with. It was a leg bag full of plasma, which was pulling him under the water, or sort of cut it loose. And he cut it loose in order to stop himself drowning, and wished he hadn't later on, because he would have loved to have had that plasma when things, you know, got serious later on. So that was a pretty harrowing start, and not untypical of what happened to a lot of the guys on that drop zone, being that it was half of it was underwater. A lot of them are landing in the water and, you know, landing with up to 90 or 100 pounds of gear strapped to you. And it's a tricky start,
to say the least. And what about Bob?
Bob had a drier start, although he did actually land right near a little stream, but he was on further inland away from the flooded area, and he was quite close to Angerville Planned Churchtown. In fact, he's only 5'4", Bob. That was his thing. So if he had landed in the water, he'd have fared less well than Ken did. Ken was 6'2", so they were slightly different in height.
There's nothing wrong with being 5'4", would he?
No, I mean, of course not. I'm not casting any negativity there. I'm just saying he was a shorter guy. And he happened to see the church tower of Angerville on a bit of high ground, I don't know, sort of 500 yards away as the crow flies, but actually to get there was hedgerows and creeks and this, that, and the other. And they weren't particularly heading for the church. It was just that it was a bit of high ground, that it was something to aim for. And the two guys ended up there coming at the church from different directions, and found that it was in the middle of a hot zone, if you like. And drop zone D was under fire. I mean, there were these German Georgian troops, and later on you have German Fallschirmjäger, so German parachute troops coming in from Carentan, and it got very traumatic. And they say that the little square in Angerville changed hands 7 or 8, 9 times on D-Day. I don't know that it actually changed hands so much as was never really firmly in anybody's hands.
Just different people on top at different times.
Yeah. And further down towards the intended battalion objective, which was another little village called Haute Adville, was the battalion colonel, Colonel Ballard. And he was already sustaining casualties because of there were men who had in the aircraft that were hit flying over. So there were jump casualties. There were men who were coming out of the water. There were others under fire. And he sent another officer under his command called Allworth to try and set up an aid station. to deal with the wounded. But in the meantime, Bob and Ken, these 20 and 19-year-old kids, had come across this church, and it's the 11th century church with big, thick walls and lots of wooden pews inside. And they thought, hey, why don't we start putting casualties in there and go from that? And in fact, Ken brought wounded men with him from the drop zone. So he had already started treating men before they even found the church.
And this is where we get to the crux of your book. I've got it. Well, how did you come up with this idea?
Oh, well, you see, it was a stop I'd been doing on my tours. I'm a battlefield guide, as you know, and I'd been touring since sort of 2002 here. And, you know, as a guide, you're doing the big high spots, like in any battlefield, like the Somme or Ypres. Yeah, there's those famous few places that everyone wants to go and see. So in this area for the American Airborne, it's Santa Mary Glees, Utah Beach, so on. And you're looking for little things that will fill in the gaps, if you like. Go to do more human interest stuff. And in 2002, a monument was put up in Angerville to these two medics. I got to know the mayor, Daniel Omchan, who was a lovely guy. And I realized that no one had actually put this story together beyond a very bare outline they printed on one piece of paper that they gave away from inside the church in English and in French about these two men who had been contacted by the villagers, and they'd both come back to Normandy over the years. But I thought, no, I realized no one had fleshed the story out and actually put the, you know, the beginning, the middle, and the end to it. And I did it. I decided to do it. And over the years, I put the story together first for my tours, and then later, and not just my tours, I had people who worked for me at the time for their tours as well. And then I thought it actually needs cataloging, and I by various contacts and people who had some information. The mayor, Daniel, about 10 years earlier, he had interviewed some of the villagers on old, grunky old cassettes, and they were speaking really hard to understand patois, slang, French. So I had to replay these tapes back and again and again and again. And with the help of various people and translators and my own knowledge, we managed to bash out what they actually said. And it was gold. It was gold. I mean, civilian accounts. And then I had the accounts from the paratroopers. I put a plea out to all my historian friends. Anybody know anybody was treated in the church? Found a few people. I knew both Bob and Ken, the two medics. They provided information for me. And then I started putting them together. And what worked wonderfully, which might not have done, is the civilian accounts tied up very nicely with the American accounts, you know, to the point where a civilian woman in a house, her account of encountering recollections of encountering a paratrooper coming into her courtyard matched up exactly with an account by an American of going into a courtyard of a French house. And you just realize, hang on, that's the same story. And how unusual it is to be able to put those two stories together, because you know yourself, Alex, with your First World War stuff, meshing civilian and military accounts, it can be really hard.
What's brilliant is you crossed in not only national boundaries by doing the French and the American, but you've crossed the language barrier as well, which is why it is a complete story.
Well, yeah, I think so, and I've had people say, you've kind of written the definitive account there, Paul. And I go, well, I think in the sense that with all the information that could have been found, like, there's no one else who could find it. There's nothing else to be found, really. I mean, yeah. I put a plea out. I'm sure people could find, maybe interpret it in a different way or put into more context or discover some more archives or something. But yeah, I was just very lucky that no one had done it before me. And with these civilian accounts and American accounts, it all just came together. And other authors I know have said some books you have to labor over, and some wrote themselves. And this one, it's my only one, I hasten to add, kind of wrote itself, because it just all gelled together perfectly. And which is cool. I mean, because and then as you said, to get both sides of the same story was really cool.
It's insane. It's brilliant. So tell us then about, did you know them, Bob and Ken?
Ken I never actually met in person. No, yeah. He'd been to Normandy, and then the times I was available, he wasn't. He didn't come to Normandy as often as Bob. I met many times and spent lots of time with. But Ken, yeah. I had done Skype interviews and telephone calls and emails. And funnily enough, I always have this fond memory of his email, because he was one of those guys who would send those forwarded emails that have been forwarded 100 times full of viruses.
Yeah.
So I had to call him up and say, Ken, you've just sent me another virus. And he'd go, what's that then? He said, yeah, well, just don't, anyway, you know, that, you know, so my memory of him is just having to overcome this old man dealing with modern 21st century computer technology. But how great it was that back there was that period when technology that I had was able to connect with veterans. Now younger people writing about World War II veterans, they've mostly gone now. They're so, to have veterans who would email you back, I mean, how cool is that? That was, you know, only 10 years ago, really.
It is, it's brilliant. So tell everyone then, what did they tell you about that day? Talk us through their version of events.
Well, that was the thing, because they're very different people. Ken, yep, you had to pull everything out like pulling teeth. And I'd have to do it in a kind of a roundabout way and ask him to talk about other people and hope he would mention himself. Bob was a little bit more in the right mood to talk about his own experiences, although in a very humble way. They both, you know, kept playing down what they did, as most veterans do. And I just did it. It was my job and those sorts of things. So it was a combination of live interviews with Bob. I also had an older interview with Bob by an American historian called Mark Bando, who's written numerous books about the 101st Airborne. He'd interviewed Bob on camera all in the early 90s. So this was when Bob was only in his, I don't know, 60s or 70s, like an hour and a half long interview when he's very, very lucid, very, very chatty. And that formed, that fleshed out what I needed. And then I could ask further questions based on what they said. So it was a very bit by bit. You get a little bit here, a little bit there. Then you ask a second question, another recollection comes back. And so I know some people who interview, you know, do one long interview with a veteran and have to work with that. I had a year of back and forth and conversations and little snippets. And Ken's next door neighbor used to go and take his questions around when she kind of came around with, you know, food for him. She'd go do him like a, you know, a casserole or something. So
yeah.
Paul said, just ask you, do you remember whether you were on the left side of the village or the right side of it? They go, left side. And that would just be one little question that I'd get ticked off. And so it was a very odd way of putting it together. But as I say, it all came together very well. And essentially the story they told me, if we, you know, go back to D-Day, is they came at this church from separate directions. They recognized it as being a suitable place to treat wounded. Bob had a little foot square Red Cross flag in his pack, which in there's a painting of Angevillo Plan someone did where the flag is like 8 foot by 10 foot across. And I thought, no, it wasn't.
Probably not.
It was just a little, like a tea towel with a cross on it. And he just pinned it to the door of the church and said, that's it, it's an aid station. And then over the next 36 hours, about 80 wounded men from both sides went through their hands, went through their care and were treated, which was absolutely insane. And what drew me to the story, and I think, you know, you're like myself, Alex, you like the humanity behind stories as well as the which battalion moved over which sector at which hour. That bit, yeah, that stuff's cool. It's that human interest stuff. And Bob and Ken had this absolute strict undertaking that they would treat anybody in need of care, be they friend or enemy. Weapons didn't come inside the church. They decided that very early on that they would stack the weapons up outside. And you know, Bob would say, he said, what we were doing was in the church was all concerned with the dead and the dying, not the winning or the losing. That could be done by other people. We are just here to save lives. And those kind of things. And that attitude is what really drew me in, and have to say is what has drawn people into the story, because it's become a very popular site on tours, not just because of my book, by no means. Other tour companies discovered the story. They got Bob and Ken had both come to Normandy. There was a documentary made in the States, which, you know, pushed a story out. It made various anniversary newspaper, you know, D-Day specials. So it's become quite a big place. And the humanity is the angle that gets across, that comes across, and you're looking for that. I am, because
always
when you're telling the story of D-Day, there's lots and lots of, and this regiment came ashore behind that regiment, and its numbers, and honestly, people can't relate to 156,000 men coming across in 6,000 ships. It's too big.
Naturally start to glaze over, don't they?
Yeah, it's So especially in the touring environment, you need something that puts people right there in the place. And the thing about the church is, for those who haven't been there, and obviously this year is a bit of a tricky one for travel, there are bloodstains on the wooden pews from where wounded men were laid. There is an impact in one of the stones where a mortar shell that came through the roof that hit the ground. Ken saw it, thought, that's it, we're all a goner, and it didn't go off. For whatever reason, it was dared or sabotaged by some brave worker in a factory, whatever, it didn't go off. Ken picked it up, threw it out the window of the church. All the windows of the church were blown out in the fighting, and you can still see that impact on the ground, and you can see the hole in the roof above it where the shell came through. I mean, you couldn't make that, you couldn't contrive that, to find that kind of story in a location where you can see it with your own eyes, because you don't get that very often. As I say, I was so lucky that no one else had done the story, because with that kind of in-house detail, I can't believe no one else had bothered to do it. But hey, I was the one who did it, so that's good.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, when you're saying about books writing themselves, the Eaton book did that. Right. Literally, all I had to do was shuffle the stories and put them in order. And obviously, there's more to it than that, and it's a labour of love, and you end up tearing your hair out. But there was never any question of what needed to go in and what was there to go in, because it was just kept presenting itself to you.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's it. And particularly for me, as interesting as it was, putting down Bob and Ken's stories, and even today you can just search Angevillo Plan Medics and there's all sorts of websites and little things come up and tributes them, which is fantastic. It was putting a name and a backstory to the three paratroopers who died in the church because their wounds were so horrific, because as we confirm, they've only got bandages, they're not fully trained, and men are coming in with wounds that are way, way more serious than they can deal with. And the three men who died, Henry Ostrovsky, Charlie Ray Johnson, and James Luce, I put their stories in as their own chapter, and I made good friends with the Ostrovsky family. And the amazing story there, by the way, I'm not going to give all the stuff away from the book.
No, you mustn't, because everyone's got to read this, because it's not the same. I mean, you're doing a great job of telling us about it, but it's not the same.
Well, I will tell a couple of things that I couldn't put in a book,
yeah.
Because just little extra details. So Henry Ostrovsky was another 19-year-old paratrooper, was wounded about a mile away from the church. And Ken had been using a farm cart he found in the farm opposite the church in the village to go and pick up wounded from up to about a mile away with just his Red Cross armband. And he would walk through the battlefields. And because by this point it was mostly Fallschirmjäger, German opponents, both sides would actually stop as they saw the medic go through and then start shooting at him again when he came back, because the Fallschirmjäger, being paratroopers, had an esprit de corps. In fact, their commanding officer, von der Heydt, who was a law professor at Columbia in the USA before the war. So he spoke English, he understood Americans, he had a real... And he's not a Heydrich kind of guy. He's a noble German who just, you know, is fighting for his men, and so he instilled in his men this, you know, you don't shoot at medics, don't kill civilians, and that's their story. And so anyway, Ken found Henry, and the bit I didn't say in the book is that Henry's face had been pretty much taken off by a mortar shell. Mm. I just said he was wounded, and Ken put him on his cart, put him back to the church, and Bob, the senior medic, remember his 3 months training, looked at Henry and realized he wasn't going to make it. And Bob could have sat Henry with all the other wounded men who had been putting on the pews. And when you see the church, the pews are tiny, right? You know, you fitting 10 people in there wounded, you could barely fit five in today. And they were cramming them in like sardines. Mm. But Bob realized if he put Ostrovsky there with the other guys, they were going to just have to sit and watch him die, because that was what was going to happen. So he kicked in the door of the sacristy behind the altar and put Henry on a kind of cupboard behind there, where over the next few hours, he literally screamed himself to death.
Oh, God.
And I couldn't put that in the book because I knew the family would read it. But I don't think they'll, because they're in the middle of the USA, I don't know that they'll discover your podcast, which is just as well in that sense. And Bob would tell me how, because he had morphine, when he heard Henry scream, he would walk over towards the door and think, I'll give that guy some morphine. And then his training kicked in, goes, no, morphine is for the living. I could have only got a little bit of this. The morphine is to keep men who are going to survive alive. And can you imagine, this is what drew me in, being a 20-year-old kid. And
making that decision.
Yeah, you are overseeing someone's death that you could make more comfortable, but you can't because you've only got limited morphine. And you think, you know, you asked me at the beginning of this, I mean, before you went, you know, you started recording, we're talking about how busy our days are, and you go, yeah, shit, what we're doing is nothing. You know,
yeah. Worries us with our headsets.
You know, just because someone hasn't answered my email today, you know, and then you realize what these guys went. And anyway, Henry died eventually. And, you know, I have copies of his letters home, this, that, you know, this, that, and the other. And one of his friends wrote to Henry's twin. Henry had a twin who was in the Pacific campaign. He was Air Force or something. And explained what happened to Henry without going into any graphic details, just, you know, how he'd lost his life. And then John, the twin, who came back from the war, survived the war. The first thing he did in Philadelphia, which is where Henry from. Incidentally, Henry Ostrowski was good friends with Bill Garnier and Babe Heffron, bringing it back to our podcast of March, which seemed like an eternity ago now. They were friends, same part of South Philly. So John got off the bus, and before going and seeing his own family, he went to see Henry because Henry'd had a girlfriend called Laura. But it was like this, and I've got their letters, Henry and Laura, it's like they really want to go stay serious, but they don't really think they should. There's a war on, and he kind of is in letters, he's saying, he's like, people are getting married these days, and I don't know, what do you think? And anyway, her family saying, no, you're not going to have anything to do with this paratrooper. And his letters to her stop, because we know he died in a church, but she doesn't know, and she has no contact with his family because they didn't, anyway. So John, the twin, comes back from the war, goes to visit Laura, his twin's nearly girlfriend, and explains what he'd found out about his twin, her boyfriend's death. And imagine that situation. Imagine how they would be comforting each other and all this. And then I'm getting this story from the twin's son. And then he said, of course, eventually they fell in love. The Laura married her late boyfriend's brother.
No
and
way.
Named the son Henry, who there was the Henry I was, because I was getting completely confused, because I was talking to a Henry Ostrowski, who was John Ostrowski's son, but named after the Henry that died. And it was, my brain was exploding. But when it all came together, you realize, oh God, you're named after your uncle who you never met.
Oh my God.
You know, that's the kind of thing that, you know, when the family, when Ostrowski's family told me how happy they were that their relative story had been told in the book. And yeah, I could have got into a bit more detail about how horrific it was, but I didn't.
You don't need that's to, when you do go, you?
That's when you go, yeah, I don't care whether anyone else buys it. You know, like with Bob himself, the medic, I'm not kind of showing off here, but his last couple of years, he was really succumbing to Alzheimer's and what have you. And he would, you know, had a little stroller thing that he'd walk around his house, and in his basket on the front, he had a copy of my book. He would kind of pick up and look at the pictures all the time. And his son would tell me how much enjoyment he got from looking at the photos of his buddies. And at this point, he wasn't really talking much anymore. You go, how cool of a reward is that? You know?
Yeah.
What
you say, who cares if no one buys it?
Exactly. So and there's more of that. You know, the other guy, I won't tell the other story. There's Charlie Ray Johnson, James Luce, the other two men in there. And, you know, when people tackle Normandy, and there are some amazing books come out the last couple of years by Caddick Adams and Hollands, all those incredible guys. And you know, but they're covering often big picture stuff, which is fantastic. But I just talked about one village of about 40 people and about 10 different paratroopers over the course of the book. But it means you're going into a level of detail that means by the end of it, theoretically, the reader feels they knew the people and they feel they have kind of been on a journey. Well, like with your Eton book, that you know, a few you can learn a lot more about via the eyes of a few people than you can by trying to read about 1,400 guys in a regiment. It doesn't, you know.
Yeah, well, you know what James is doing since we did Band of Brothers and talked about following individuals and people and looking at smaller. He's doing a start to finish, isn't he? Following
he is. He's doing his Starlight Rangers book. Yeah. So
which apparently is our fault. Because of the whole Band of Brothers thing.
As long as we get a nice thank you, as long as
there's gin in it at some point for me. But
exactly, yeah.
You said you spoke to some of the people that survived. I'm really interested. What did they tell you? What was their perception of Bob and Ken on that day?
Well, I got accounts of people who'd survived, but the particular accounts I got, they'd actually died before I came. Elroy Hugh was one of them. So his son, Jim, gave me, his father had written his memoirs down.
Yeah.
So I had the full story about how it was to survive there, but I didn't meet any. In fact, one of the very sad, I'm going to answer a question you didn't ask, but I'm going to go in a politician's way and answer something different. Bob, because Bob was just a medic in Normandy. He went on to Market Garden and the island in Nijmegen and the Ardennes, you know, Bastogne, doing exactly the kind of same kind of stuff as Doc Rowe did in the Band of Brothers, all the way through the end of the war, survived all the way through. One silver star, three bronze stars. Ken survived all the way through as well. Now, Bob went to pretty much every 101st or 501st reunion he could go to after war because he was hoping to meet one of the men he'd saved over the course of the war. Not in any kind of you owe me a beer kind of way, but just that sense of closure.
Yeah.
And interestingly, he never met anybody he treated in the war, or at least that they could kind of double confirm. Because if you're lying on a stretcher as a wounded guy, you're not necessarily going to take a note of the guy who comes over and jabs a morphine syringe in you. And, you know, you've got other things to think about, like surviving. But Bob never met anybody who he treated in the war. And that's one of the things that has dawned on me since I did the book. Because if you'd interviewed me just a few months after I did it, I wouldn't have had half the answers. Because it's taken a few years for it all to, you know, bubble and simmer. And I realized that, because I was frustrated when I wrote it, that I didn't get many of the names of the guys who were treated. Of the 80 or so guys in the church, I got about five or six names, plus fortunately the three guys who died. That came together quite well. But that's like 15% of the guys who were treated. And I was frustrated. Then I realized, shit, Woody, you fool. Those guys went on through three or four more campaigns and half of them probably didn't survive the war. And that's the realization that you patch up a guy in combat to be in the face of it again in the next campaign. And that's why I've spoken to a lot, because I've taken people to the church and done really long versions of stories. If they're doctors or medics or nurses or paramedics, because they completely get that idea of triage and choosing who's going to survive, but focusing on those going to survive and making no decisions. And they get it. They get all that. And the realization that if you're working in an ER department in a hospital and someone comes in after a horrific car wreck, you're really unlikely to see them come in again 6 months later in another horrific car wreck and then 6 months later in another horrific car wreck. But in World War II, with the campaigns these guys went through, there's a lot of chance that you're going to get hit again. I mean, look, the Purple Hearts that were awarded to units like the 101st, the 1st Infantry, and of course us Brits, we didn't have that Purple Heart equivalent. So it's harder for us, as you know, to trace wounds because they didn't get recorded with that very precise allocation of a medal. And that's why I didn't find more men who survived the church, because they had died during the war. But that only took me years after writing the book that was why I didn't find them, because they just went back in the line again. Yeah. The losses those guys face, you know what it's, how it was in the Ardennes for the 101st and in the Market Garden. These guys went and through the mill. So Bob never, as I say, confirmed, Bob never met anybody who he'd saved in the war. And that caused him much trauma. He kind of went through this, what was it all worth it? And that's why I'm not, I'm happy to kind of share some of those stuff that Bob and Ken shared after the book came out, rather than just say to you today what's already in the book. And Ken had a regret, for example, that there were two Germans in the church tower that came down on day two, and no one, you know, has his idea why they hadn't come down further earlier, and they were probably artillery spotters. And the exciting thing is, and the humanitarian side of it is, these two German kids volunteered to help out, and they helped and assisted Bob and Ken in giving water and adjusting the toilet case. But Ken had felt such a connection and affinity with these two German kids that when the village was liberated, and it was liberated by Colonel Sink and the 506th, and the first two men through the door of the church upon liberation were two individuals by the name of Dick Winters and Carl Wood Lipton. Slightly famous, which I didn't actually stress in my book. I didn't want to go on about it. Oh, let's have the Easy Company chapter and make it in another Band of Brothers book. I just kind of downplayed that. Anyway, Ken took these two German kids off to the front line and said, go on, try and get back to your lines. And I put a request in German in a few German newspapers back in 2012, the year before the book came out, saying, anybody know, anybody heard a story from a veteran about, you know, a German veteran about being in a church tower above an aid station in Normandy and seeing these medics working? I was very vague.
Yeah.
And no one came back. Now, maybe the right people didn't read the newspaper articles, or more likely, those two German kids went back in the line and got killed a day later. Mm. So Ken's regret was he just should have kept them prisoner, put them in the POW cage like the others, almost certainly guarantee their survival. And that's that interesting thing of that these guys, as medics, they had a lot of thought about loss and life and living and survival. And they both were quite philosophical as they got older and, you know, and looked on these things and had these regrets. And Bob, Charlie Ray Johnson, this is another bit that's not in the book, who is the second guy who died. A few years ago, when Bob was still alive, he went to a reunion somewhere or an event somewhere and was talking about Charlie Ray Johnson's injuries. And he was hit in the head. Well, he was hit in the body first, then hit in the head by a single round. And Bob described these injuries to a doctor, a current modern, you know, doctor.
Yeah.
The doctor said, oh, well, I'm sure if we got him to a proper, you know, AER, he'd have survived. That sounds like it was, and he kind of diagnosed it. And Bob then felt really bad that this guy could have been saved had he had another procedure. And I don't know who that doctor was. And if I could go find that doctor and say,
and slap him.
What were you doing?
Just.
You were talking to an old man with PTSD. Don't tell him one of the men he could have, you know, he lost.
You tell him he did everything he could.
So
leave it at that.
So the very last time I saw Bob, and I honestly forget which year it was now, 2011, 2012. I don't know. Because he didn't travel the last few years because of health issues. Where he'd been able to go back to the church before that and embrace the fact that people would thank him for saving lives. He was very humble. He didn't kind of shout about it, but you could see him proud. The last time, and I was privileged to be the one who escorted him in the church, he walked up the altar near where Charlie Johnson died. And he just started bursting into tears and going, no, I could have done more. I could have done more. And I'm going, Bob, you know, because you don't want to be angry with him, but he was kind of amazed. And Bob, there's 79 other men who you did save. So, you know, just, but you can't tell a guy to, you know, ignore this feeling that's been building for, at this point, whatever it was, 66, 8 years or something.
Yeah. You can, however, if you're out there, that doctor, I shake my fist at you.
Yeah, I mean, maybe the story got told to me in a different kind of way, and maybe the doctor wasn't doing it in that kind of way. But honestly, you know, the responsibility of seeing people with PTSD and understanding, you know, that comes with interviewing veterans. And you know, I get a little bit of criticism because I'm not a qualified historian. You know, I left the school at 16 and stuff, but I've interviewed and spoken to 2,000 World War II veterans over the years, and you learn very quickly how to ask questions and what not to say and how to steer things along. And I may not have been trained to do that, but I learned.
No, there's plenty of historians without enough basic humanity who haven't got a clue how to talk to veterans. So don't put yourself down.
Yeah. And I got quite good at it by the end. And you know, so yeah, Bob and Ken, I can honestly say, I mean, I never met Ken, but their influence on my life is something that I'll carry with me till I'm, you know, however old I want to end up being, you know. And Bob, incidentally, and this is quite well known on the internet, Bob's ashes, or half of them, were scattered in the churchyard at Angavillo Plan. And there's a little marker there indicating, which broke all the laws in France, because you're not meant to bury a non-Catholic, non-Frenchman. Anyway, we did it anyway, and no one ever.
Yeah. It's one of those times where you go, just look the other way.
Yeah, if I get to the, if there's a guard and I get there and they're listing through my demeanours, and they say, well, you're part of an illegal burial of a veteran's ashes, I'll go, yeah, really? That's all you've got? If that's all they've got against me, you know, I'll take that. But I know that when I'm there on a tour, and of course there's been no, at this point, end of September, I should have done about 120 battlefield tours by now. I've done six this.
So depressing, isn't it?
Sorry. Been terrible. But I know that when I'm telling the story, Bob's ashes are out there. But you know, he's kind of out there in the presence of, you know, so I'm thinking to myself, make sure you tell it right, Paul. And Ken would say to me, when I put the phone down to Ken, he would say, don't forget to tell them that we were shit scared all the time, Paul.
Yeah.
Don't let them think that we were cruising through this in control. We were shit scared all the time and we were completely out of our depth. And he said, the way you structured it in the book made it look like we knew what we were doing. We knew what we were doing on an individual case basis, but we didn't know that it was going to be 36 hours. We didn't know the relief was going to come this, that. Yeah, they didn't know. So yeah, and another little thing I'm going to tell you, because you've got me on a roll now.
Do it.
Is and there was a German officer who went in there for treatment. That was all exciting as well. And Bob, and the Germans had control of the village at this time. And even though the Germans have got their own machine guns and mortars set up outside, and Bob could have been shot, Bob didn't let the German come in unless he took his pistol belt off. And you're going, yeah, that German could have just shot you.
This is a teenager, essentially. So yeah. This is how it's going to be. To a guy with a gun.
Yeah, and with lots of other guys behind him with bigger guns. And he stood up in a broad doorway and said, you're not coming in. And this guy had as Bob would say, a life-changing injury. It was in the groinal area.
Oh, no.
And eventually the guy slipped off his pistol belt and came in, and Bob treated him. He said, that's it. I'm not, because he said, Bob squared up to him. He said, it's my rules. He said, unless you've got another aid station you can go to.
If you ever want to use it again, you play by my rules.
Yeah, and the counterpoint of that, which I think is so wonderful, is when the village is liberated and the arrival of help comes from Utah Beach, a few miles, when all the surviving wounded get taken away to a proper hospital, and the three guys that had died in the church, in fact, one may have died after he was near to death, may have died about a mile away, but the two that had died, Johnson and Ostrowski, they'd been buried in like a shallow graves under the yew trees. They were being taken away. But an American 101st Airborne artillery officer came up and wanted to use the tower of the church to direct artillery fire on the now retreating Fauchemager towards Carentan. Mm. But at this point, the aid station is still, you know, functioning. There's still a Red Cross flag on it. There's still people being coming in and out. And Bob said, no, you're not coming inside the church until it is ended as an aid station, because the Germans respected its neutrality. And if we're going to win this war, we must respect exactly the same rules. And this artillery officer, this American artillery officer, was demanding access to the church. And it probably would have given his guns an advantage. But there are rules. And the rules were that it's now a neutral location. So this officer, never found out who he was, went off and, like a little girl, blabbed to Colonel Ballard, this nasty medic wouldn't let me inside the church. This nasty, because Bob was a corporal, a T5, it's a technical.
Yeah. Corporal.
And the Ballard, the colonel, said, yeah, what were you doing? He said, well, I wanted to get my spotters in the church, but it was still an eye station. He said, yeah, you're in the wrong there, you know, yeah. And Bob got in no trouble. But to stand up that way as a 19, 20-year-old medics, that's where you get the respect for them, is that we're medics, we have a duty to be fair to everybody, and that's what we're going to do. And to me, that's the important thing that I wanted to get across, and hopefully did. With the
100%.
Books.
Woody, it's an amazing story. It is, like you say, it's a snapshot of just less than 100 people on D-Day in the midst of hundreds of thousands of people trying to get their shit done. And it's exceptional. And we love it. Tell people again what it's called. I'm going to put a link on the podcast website so people can click straight through and buy it.
Well, it's called Angels of Mercy. Two screaming eagle medics in Angervilla plan on D-Day. And it, interestingly, that wasn't my choice for the title.
No.
It was given to me by the mayor of the village, who had been so helpful in getting it, because, and I'll do that story briefly, then I'll shut up.
No, keep going. People love it.
There were two twin brother doctors who wandered the Mediterranean during Roman era, and they gave treatment to people regardless of their faith, color, creed, and this, that, and the other. And because they crossed borders and what have you, they were eventually arrested by the Romans and they were killed, possibly crucified for being Christians. A few hundred years later, Emperor Justinian, a now Christian emperor, is dying of some ailment that no one can determine what it is. And he prays, and two angels descend from the heavens, and they save him, and he had them sainted. And they are Saints Cosmos and Damien, who are big in the Orthodox faith, and they're in Catholic faith as well. And hundreds of years ago, and no one knows exactly when, let's say 600 years ago, the church in Angervilla Plan was dedicated to these two angels. It's the only church in France I've ever found that's dedicated to Saints Cosmos and Damien, or Com in French. There's a Saint Com du Mont just down the road from Angerville. Mm. So Com, Cosmos, same dude. And when I was doing the book, Daniel, the mayor, said, this church was already visited by two angels who descended from the heavens to save someone, Cosmos and Damien. And on D-Day, two more angels descended from the heavens, paratroopers, Bob and Ken. And you must call it Angels of Mercy. So, all right, yep, yeah, okay, fine. Because, as you know, titles are, you know, they're difficult to think
about. The last thing you give a crap about when you're trying to write a whole book, isn't it?
So, you know, and some people like that whole religious element of the connection and what have you. And I put a few of those bits in the book. The church is on the Crusader route as well. So there are Knights Hospitalier crosses inside the church, which is another connection with medicine and medics. And I've put that in the book as well to flesh it out. I mean, it doesn't float my boat, the religious side of things, but no. I understand some people it does. And for the villagers, it was a very important part of the story. So I put some of the civilian stories and some of the civilian casualties who died. And because when you go there now, there's three names on the war monument of civilians, because for a village of 40, you're not going to get more than three.
Yeah.
But the three stories are in the book again, because, you know, it's part of the village. And so I fleshed that. One was a 10-year-old girl who died on a booby trap just after D-Day by pulling on a bit of parachute cord, thinking it was going to pull out a bit of parachute silk to make some underwear or something. And it wasn't. It was a German booby trap, and a grenade went off and she was killed.
Just like you say, we've said it already, I love that you've got the civilian side of it as well, and that it is the entire story of that village, and it's not just sort of like the English language version of it, which is great. What would you have called it?
Oh, I don't know.
I thought you had something in
no,
your head.
No, I never had to think of anything. I probably would have used Geronimo, because Geronimo is a nickname of the 501st. So I probably would have, you know, Geronimo's at war or something, or the Geronimo aid station or something. I don't know. But I wouldn't have gone with Angels of Mercy. And interestingly, the difficult thing for me is because I called it rather pretentiously the Normandy Chronicles Volume 1. I had this intention to do a Volume 2 and Volume 3. And various ideas have come and gone. But the thing is, when you've done what I think is a really good story, finding a second follow-up is really hard. And the other ideas I thought about never kind of came to fruition. So, yeah, when people say, is there a volume two? No, there is as yet no volume two.
I just assumed you were lazy and hadn't bothered.
Well, there's that as well. Yeah, no, I mean, there is that, you know, because, yeah, but I just never – sometimes you find that one story and you go, yeah, that's it. And I was lucky enough to find that one story, and it was a pleasure to write, not to edit. We all hate the editing, don't
yes.
we? But the writing was great, and it opened doors for me, and it's still selling. I self-published, and it's sold, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 copies over the years. It's done all right for a little independent book. So I'm happy enough with it.
But well, there'll definitely be some more after this goes out. As I say, I'm going to put the link on the podcast website underneath the description so people can go straight
well,
there and
much.
Buy it. And we must get together soon and do some more TV stuff. They were great fun.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, you know, because we've both, you and I have both come out of, and Alina, of course, come out of this whole year with new directions in our careers that we didn't know we were going to go down particular paths. And It's been an extraordinary year, and we had lots of plans. That some of them happened and some of them didn't. But yeah, we should do more things, because there's lots of avenues I think that we could get involved in.
Brilliant. Well, we look forward to it. Thanks so much, Woody.
Well, no, it's my pleasure. I haven't told this. Normally, I'd have told it like 120 times by now. This is like the second time this year. I did it another thing around June, so it's a pleasure to go and tell some of the stories. And if anyone watching, listening, please visit the church when you can travel again, because it's an amazing place with, the blood stains and the impacts there. And there's an information panel just outside the church that tells you the story. That I contributed the text of, so you can kind of go there and understand it. And the reason it works is you can see it all happening. You can stand in that church and you can picture the medics coming in the door. You can see where the wounded there were, because you can see the blood stains, and it's easy to take on board. Picturing huge invasions and movements, it's very hard to relate to that. And so it's an amazing place, and I'm an atheist, but I'm less of an atheist when I'm in that church. I feel maybe there's something going on that I don't know about, you know. Anyway, I'll stop rambling.
Join us tomorrow when Tim Reynolds will be with us to talk all about the origins of modern man. This is brilliant. So we had Matt Pope on to talk about Neanderthals, and now we're going to talk about our own subspecies, and we're going to talk about the differences, similarities, and fill in some more prehistory for you. So don't miss it. Don't forget, you can become a patron of History Hack for as little as $1 a month. Just go to www.historyhack.podbean.com. It will help us keep going in the aftermath of the coronavirus, and we would really appreciate it, as we would love to do so.